Welcome to this special event of University of Chicago Beijing Center and the Institute for Molecular Engineering. My name is Sharon Fang. I'm the Executive Director for the Institute for Molecular Engineering. And before we started this evening's main presentation, I just wanted to say a few words for those friends who probably are still not very familiar with who is Institute for Molecular Engineering and what we're doing. So the Institute for Molecular Engineering is established in 2011, is the first engineering program in the entire history of University of Chicago. So basically the university has the vision that wanted to extend on the basis of excellence of our scientific research, that has always been the case, and really want to expand into a further translational application of the technology development to take these scientific results into technologies that can actually have significant societal impact. So that's the vision that enables the establishment of Institute for Molecular Engineering. And since then, we have been building this institute, which is really not only a research institute, but also has its own power, appoint its own faculty, and has its own academic program granting both PhD degree right now, and maybe the BS degree in the future. So it's been a really very exciting journey for all of us who involved in this building up this institute. And we're really fortunate to really have this opportunity to introduce to you our institute and some of the science that's ongoing right now. So I'm going to give the time to Danielle to introduce our speaker this evening, the founding Pritzker Director of the Institute of Molecular Engineering, Dr. Matt Turrell.
Thank you. All right, so welcome everyone to the University of Chicago Center in Beijing. If it's your first time, welcome here, and if it's your 20th time, welcome back. So a few quick words about the center in Beijing. I'm a program coordinator here for student programs for undergraduates. We have student programs here. We have large academic collaborations and conferences. And then we also have open events like this that are open to the public and to interested folks around Beijing. So thank you so much for attending tonight. So I'm going to quickly introduce Professor Turrell. He's the founding Pritzker Director of the new IME, going into its, I guess, fourth year now. And so he's a pioneering researcher in the fields of biomolecular engineering and nanotechnology, and he specializes in the manipulation and measurement of the surface properties of polymers, which are materials that consist of long, flexible chain molecules. His work has provided new insight into polymer properties. And so a quick background on Professor Turrell. He received his BS degree in chemical engineering from Northwestern University up the coast from UChicago, and received his PhD in polymer science and engineering from the University of Massachusetts. He began his career as an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota, later served as the head of the Department of Chemical and Material Engineering there, and then moved to University of California at Santa Barbara, where he was dean of engineering. After he was there for 10 years, he moved to University of California at Berkeley, where he served, again, as chair for the Department of Bioengineering. And then in 2011, he came to University of Chicago to help get the IME off of the ground. So, Professor Turrell, welcome to China, and thanks so much for speaking at the center tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to talk a lot about our own research as a way of illustrating the kinds of things that we're doing, and I put this in a context that I don't usually do, which is this idea of P4 medicine, because I think it might have a little more general interest as you try to understand where what I'm going to tell you about fits into what you might be seeing in your own healthcare over the next decade or so. P4 medicine is a term coined by Leroy Hood, who's now the director of the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle, Washington. And it stands for those four adjectives at the top there: predictive, preventive, personalized, and participatory. And the idea is really that there's going to be a different kind of engagement of us, with our own healthcare, and it results from, among other things, the four ellipses that you see around this thing of systems medicine. The first and maybe most important one being biology as an information science. We don't always think it that way. I mean, of course, you try to get information from your doctor, but the nature of information is really expanding. And that's happening because of emerging technologies, new analytical tools, new ways of really analyzing information that we have, not just acquiring it, and let's call it a more holistic approach to healthcare. You can't read this article here, but this was an article in Nature a couple of months ago about a project being driven by Leroy Hood called the 100-Person Wellness Project. And he's gotten 100 ostensibly well and physically fit people to volunteer to have massive data taken about them over the next 3 months and see what happens to them in the ensuing years and what might be predicted from the massive data that they take about them over the next several months. And this has to do with functioning of organs from the brain and the heart to the digestive system, to the lymphatic system, and so on. So I don't really know how this is going. I haven't seen a snapshot of it, but it gives you an idea of the kind of data cloud that is going to inform this style of P4 medicine. But how do we get all the information we want? And even right now, there's not good ways to get certain kinds of information, and that's really what the first part of the title of my talk implies. What about conditions that really have no symptoms? Where what you really want to do is take a look inside somehow and see what's going on. And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to develop. So we're going to take a look at two leading causes, ultimately, of mortality. And our focus recently has been on cardiovascular disease. What you see here are the mortality rates in the U.S. for cardiovascular disease and cancer, and this is women on the left and men on the right. Overall, there's not a huge difference, so it's not really that significant to differentiate the two populations. But what you do see is that by a significant margin, cardiovascular disease is a more significant cause of morbidity and mortality than cancer in both men and women. And yet, I think a lot more of the nanomedicine that I'm going to tell you about is directed toward cancer detection than it is toward heart disease. And I'm not sure why that is, honestly. By heart disease, we mean atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries. And the progression looks something like this inside an artery, where the initial event is the buildup of lipids or fat in the blood vessel wall that produces a form of inflammation so that white blood cells go into the blood vessel wall to try to remove the lipid or fat deposit, which they don't usually do very successfully. And so what happens is you get dead cells and more fat deposits in the blood vessel wall, leading to this deposit known as an atheroma. That's not particularly dangerous in itself. It's a very slowly progressing disease, and really what matters is what happens after that. And this can lead to one of two end states over many, many years. One is, and I'll take these a little bit of out of order, one happens when the covering of this fatty deposit is very strong and robust. There's a fibrous capsule over top of it. It's a little bit like scar tissue. And the fatty deposit is stable. It can continue to grow. And eventually, there's some significant occlusion of the blood vessel that leads to a symptom. If this is a coronary artery, it could be chest pain. If it's a leg artery, it could be leg pain. But you can go in there and intervene and do something about it. You can bypass the artery with surgery. You can blow up a balloon inside the artery, which is called angioplasty, and then hold it open with a stent. So while that's serious, it's treatable. The problem is that in something like 35 to 40% of the cases of atherosclerosis progressing this way, before you get to this stage, this happens. The plaque ruptures, and there's a massive blood clot that causes a very serious heart attack. And so in 34 or 40% of the cases, a massive heart attack with preceded by no symptoms and sometimes leading to sudden death is the first symptom of the disease progression. So how would you detect something like that? And unlike cancer, this is a disease that doesn't produce circulating markers of the disease. So, you know, in fact, the kind of data that would be collected as envisioned in Lee Hood's wellness project would have a chance of detecting circulating tumor cells or DNA from tumors circulating in the blood. There is really no circulating signal of this kind of heart disease. So what we're trying to do is devise ways of going in there and finding it, even though it doesn't have any symptoms. Now, you can't get this directly from normal imaging technologies, and there's several ways that one tries to image heart disease. The most prominent ones are angiography or CT scanning, which are different ways of using X-rays to see these things. MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, is being used increasingly. This is what a CT scan looks like, and you can see that a significant narrowing of the blood vessel is detectable there, and significant plaques are detectable there. This is angiography, where you can see the narrowing. You can't really easily see these other plaques, so imaging methods are not even that great for seeing things, but they are especially incapable of determining what the state of that plaque is. Remember I told you the crucial thing between a stable and an unstable plaque is actually how strong the fibrous capsule is over top of the plaque or what's going on there, and these imaging techniques don't give you any idea of that. So what we're trying to do is detect something along here that tells you something about the early progression of the disease that might be useful in the overall healthcare environment. And to that end, what we've done is invent some nanoparticles that we call peptide amphiphile micelles. We started calling them these partly because my wife's name is Pam, and some of the graduate students in my group thought that was humorous, so we call them PAMs. but they are what are called self-assembled nanoparticles, and they're made out of these molecules here, where we take a molecule called a peptide, which means a small piece of protein that is capable of binding to the pathological tissue that we're trying to find. We usually either discover it by some empirical method, what peptide to use, or we know something about a protein that binds to a certain thing, and we synthesize that little piece of protein. And then we link it to a hydrophobic tail, just meaning a lipid tail, and that causes these hydrophobic tails to come together in a core here and make a micelle, which is a small spherical nanoparticle, typically 10 nanometers in diameter, that displays 80 to 100 peptides on the surface. And these things have a lot of useful properties, some of which are relevant to this talk, some of which aren't. They're biodegradable and biocompatible. They can be made specific for a certain kind of tissue targeting. They can be taken up by cells. They have a property, which is maybe the most useful one here, that we call multivalency, which means not only is there one targeting molecule on this micelle, but there's 80 to 100 of them. So it gets multiplied. The avidity of the interaction gets multiplied by a big factor, and so on. By the way, this is a movie poster from a movie that was made when I was 16 years old, starring Raquel Welch, which made a big impression on me when I was 16 years old. about people who miniaturize themselves and move through the blood vessels to, I think, detect a stroke in one of the leading men's brain here and fix it. You know, what we're doing is not that sensational or even that interesting, maybe, but it has some of the same features of moving through the blood vessel to find something dangerous. We make these molecules in our own lab. Actually, you can make peptides on a machine now. So when I say peptides, I mean something that might have 5 to 15 amino acids in it. And really, with the modern technology, some of which was invented by Lee Hood, actually, you can just dial in the peptide you want to make and leave the machine to run overnight and make it. And then we attach these hydrophobic tails that bring these things together in the spherical micelle nanoparticle that we use. We first started using these because we wanted to modify surfaces. We also thought about them as synthetic mimics of cell membranes, where a bilayer membrane could encapsulate an aqueous interior. But what I'm going to talk about is totally this picture. Like I said, a characteristic size of about 10 nanometers with the hydrophobic tails anchoring a display of peptides on the surface. Micelles should be relatively well known to you. This is a video produced by Paul Mitchell, which is a personal care products company, that shows what happens with typical detergent molecules. You've used micelles all the time. They are the effective thing that when soap helps get soap off your, when soap gets grease off your hands or off your dishes or out of your clothing, what happens is that these hydrophobic tails come together and create an environment inside of water that grease can dissolve in. And so I'll just show you this to make a little bit more vivid what we're talking about when we say we're making a micelle. This is a picture of a drop of soap, and these are the soap molecules dancing around inside this droplet of soap. These are the hydrophobic tails right there. In most soaps, these are ionic head groups, so these are highly charged head groups, and that's what makes the thing soluble in water. In a minute, we're going to drop a drop of this soap into water, or a lot of this soap into water. I guess it's more than a drop. And now you'll look at how these things aggregate when they're dumped into water. What happens now is the hydrophobic tails, hydrophobic means they hate water, start to aggregate with one another to get away from the water, and they start to make these things, where the hydrophobic tails come together and make a micelle. That's what we're doing, except that we have peptide molecules that have biological activity sticking out from that object on the outside. So that's our nanoparticle core, and then we have biological targeting peptides on the outside of it. And it looks like that. So that's the kind of thing that we make. These are somewhat analogous to protein molecules because proteins fold, that is, they get their three-dimensional shape, by putting hydrophobic amino acids on the inside and their biologically active stuff on the outside, and they're about the same size as protein molecules. So in some ways, we're trying to make synthetic mimics of proteins when we make these protein-analogous micelles. So here's one that we've developed to target one stage of coronary artery disease. And we've done one more thing, or two more things, in this micelle construction than I've showed you so far. First of all, the peptide that we use is a short one. This thing that looks like a word that says CRECA here is a 5 amino acid peptide. It stands for cysteine, arginine, glutamate, lysine, alanine. So it's a 5 amino acid peptide. We attach a fluorescent label to it so we can find it once we put it into the body. And the other thing that we do that I hadn't told you about so far is we put a long polymer spacer in there so that the final object that we make has a hydrophobic core, a peptide on the outside, but a swollen boundary of polymer molecules there that drives this thing into a spherical shape, and it also pushes the peptide to the outside of these nanoparticles. So we make a micelle out of nanoparticles that looks like this, and now we're going to try to use it to detect atherosclerotic plaque. This is another image of the progression of the disease. Here's a healthy blood vessel wall. Here's one where fat has begun to enter the blood vessel wall, so white blood cells are beginning to be attracted to this region of the blood vessel wall and move in to try to absorb the lipid, but they don't. They usually die inside of there, and the atheroma builds up. And then the final stage, before there's any serious massive event, is in fact small ruptures of the blood vessel. Before there's this massive rupture that I pictured before, there are usually small blood clots appearing from microscopic tears on the surface. And this peptide that we're using here, this thing we call CRCA, is a peptide that is known to home very seriously, very strongly, to blood clots. It actually binds one of the major proteins in blood clots. So you should think about this as a blood clot targeting micelle or nanoparticle. And so we're going to be targeting this late stage thing with this when we put CRCA on here and we make a micelle that has CRCA and a fluorescent label. So how do you test something like this? You don't just start with human beings, as you can imagine. The work that we've done so far has been with mice. Mice don't get atherosclerosis, partly because they only live 2 years, partly because they eat a healthy diet for mice, which is called chow, or, you know, a lot of greens. But you can create a mouse that does get atherosclerosis by, first of all, creating a transgenic mouse where the gene to produce high-density lipoprotein is missing. So-called good cholesterol is missing in this mouse's makeup. And then what you do is feed them what's called a Western diet for several weeks. I don't know what happens to them if you feed them a Chinese diet, but we could find out if you want. But if you take one of these genetic knockout mice and you feed it a high-fat diet, they develop heart disease in a few weeks. And in fact, they develop fairly late-stage heart disease in about 10 weeks, something where one can expect there to be blood clots on the surface of the atherosclerotic plaques. So the experiment that we do is we condition these transgenic mice by feeding them a high-fat diet. And then when we're ready to do the experiment, we inject a suspension of our micelles into the tail vein of the mouse. And then in these experiments, we sacrifice the mouse after 3 hours and look at the blood vessels in the mouse. I'll show you in a minute. You don't actually have to sacrifice the mice. Well, I'll show you what happens. But at any rate, then we harvest the blood vessels, and you can see that our green fluorescent label is very present when we have the CRCA, not when we have micelles. If we make micelles that have the fluorescent label and everything else except the CRCA, we do not see anything in the blood vessels of the mice. So CRCA is what's targeting these things here. So we have a peptide that can carry these micelles to the site of atherosclerotic plaque. We can also look at the cross-section here and see that there are atherosclerotic lesions in these things. So the way we've done this experiment, you wouldn't exactly consider it diagnostic from the mouse's point of view, but what we're aiming for is better imaging technologies where we can do this eventually on people. You can actually see that the site of where these micelles accumulate and where there's the most blood clot proteins is right in the region where the covering of the atherosclerotic plaque separates from the blood vessel wall. So we're actually learning a little something about the genesis of the disease as well. Okay, well, this is a very late stage of coronary artery or of cardiovascular disease. We've been working over the last year or two to try to detect much earlier stages. In fact, could we detect the first stages of inflammation before you built up even a significant atheroma? So the difference in conditioning the mice to get to the stage where you can see microscopic blood clots in the mouse takes about 12 weeks of conditioning the mice. If we condition them just for 5 or 6 weeks, we have a much earlier stage of coronary artery disease, and we can try to look at, is there something we can detect very early? And Eunji Chung in my lab has been working with a peptide right here. It's a little bit longer peptide that binds to the surface of white blood cells. So now we have a micelle that doesn't seek out blood clot, but seeks out white blood cells. Can we see that there are white blood cells attacking a certain portion of the blood vessel wall that's an indication of inflammation there? And Eunji's been able to do that, and you can see that this is just how bright the fluorescence is when she looks in the same kind of experiment after injecting this kind of a micelle into the mice, letting it circulate for several hours, and then imaging. The control experiment here is to take the same construct and even the same amino acids here, but put them in a scrambled order so that while you have the same charge and the same molecular weight and so on, you will not have the same pattern of amino acids. And so this scrambled peptide does not have the targeting capability. And this is one of the controls that shows we are really targeting the early stage atherosclerotic plaque. The other is that you can extract the blood vessels again, and you can see bright red fluorescence in this case and no fluorescence in this case. And then we've had another idea, which also seems to have some promise. Instead of waiting for the inflammation to occur, why do these white blood cells get there in the first place? They get there because the blood vessel is giving out signals. And they give out signals by displaying this molecule known as vascular cell adhesion molecule right here that attracts the white blood vessels. And Laurie Drews in my group has created a micelle that detects the presence of these upregulated VCAM molecules. So she can detect the very earliest stages of inflammation. And this is what you see. And these imaging photographs are taken on live mice. You can do fluorescence on living mice. You can't do them on living human beings, and I'll get to that in a second. Because we're too big. But in these mice, you really need a trained eye to know what you're looking at. And for the time being, forget about these pictures. But in these mice, there's no VCAM targeting micelle here. And what we see is that the bright fluorescence ends up either in the liver or in the bladder. Whereas when we have the targeting molecules, the VCAM ends up in the heart. Just think sort of heart, liver, bladder. And so if there's no targeting molecule, these things either get filtered out in the liver or get passed through the kidneys into the bladder and into urine. But when we target it, we see them in the blood vessels around the heart. So we have two promising methods for detecting very early stage inflammation and the early stage development of coronary artery disease. But these things will never go into humans unless we can do a little bit more than that. And what we have to do more than that is actually figure out a way that we could image these things in human beings. And we could talk a little bit more about how this might actually be used if we can do this in clinical practice. But what we're looking at now is incorporating a small amount of another molecule into these micelles that incorporates the metal ion gadolinium, which is a typically used contrast agent in either X-ray or in MRI. And so we think there's some chances that this could be something that could be used to detect early stage heart disease in human beings. And then, of course, we'd actually like to do some treatment of these things. Since these nanoparticles have some capacity to carry things through the bloodstream, we've been thinking about what could you carry to the blood clot at the same time you detected it that would also treat it. And we've proven that that can be done because we've attached a different peptide, these red crosses, that actually is an anticoagulant peptide. And we've shown that we can see the activity of the anticoagulant peptide brought there by the micelle. So we think there's some really powerful possibilities for this kind of micellar therapy. I put up this slide not because I really want you to read it. I just want you to see how big it is. This is a review article from a review article that was written about 2.5 years ago. And this lists all the known examples of using nanoparticles to treat heart disease. There's about 18. If you tried to make a list like this of the nanoparticles to treat cancer, it would be about 18 million. It would be a scroll that went from here back to Chicago. A lot more nanomedicine attention has been devoted to cancer than it has to heart disease, and we're trying to correct that. But having said that, we actually are trying to do some things on cancer ourselves because it's obviously important and an important target. And in fact, the same peptide that we use to target atherosclerotic plaque can be used to target tumors because the peptide that we use doesn't actually target plaque or tumors. It targets blood clots. And essentially all solid tumors have blood clots in them. That's because cancer grows more rapidly than other tissue. It needs blood vessels, but the blood vessels that are in tumors are generally poorly formed, and so they leak. And so there's almost always blood clots in tumors, and we have the perfect tool for detecting blood clots. So we've done experiments like this where we, create a mouse model, in this case with breast tumor tissue, grafting it into the mouse, allowing it to engraft for several weeks, and then injecting a suspension of our micelles into the tail vein of the mouse, allowing it to circulate for a few hours, and then sacrificing the animal and extracting the tumor, and you can see that our green fluorescent micelles really overlap very strongly with the tumor. So we also have some pretty good tumor targeting activity with these things. Most recently, we've been trying to use this with brain cancer, a glioblastoma, which is a very dangerous form of brain cancer, that again, we produce a mouse model by inserting the tumor tissue into the brain of a mouse and then looking at the fluorescence at various stages after 15 days after we inject our micelles. So in every case, we're looking 15 days after we inserted the tumor tissue into the mouse's brain. In this case, we then inject the micelles and look at 1, 2, and 3 hours. In this case, we inject the micelles on day 14 and look a day afterwards. In this case, we inject the micelles on day 8 and look 7 days afterward. And you can see the accumulation of this red fluorescence in the mouse's brain very quickly after the injection of these micelles in the tail vein of the mouse. We're not injecting these things in the tumor. We're injecting these things very distant, and these things are lighting up the mouse's brain. I think this could be particularly useful, not really necessarily for detecting whether there's a tumor or not, but eventually for detecting whether you've gotten all of the tumor out or not, all of the tumor tissue out or not. This is what it looks like after 3 hours compared to one, a micelle that doesn't have Krika on it. After 24 hours, the signal's even stronger. But after 7 days, it's completely gone. So these things are cleared from the system. That's one of the reasons why I say these things are biocompatible. These micelles do not seem to cause any health difficulties or organ damage to the mouse, and they seem to be completely cleared after several days. So I have some hopes for them. So I'm very high on these kind of micellar nanoparticles as potential diagnostic and therapeutic agents. Back in the spirit of healthcare, when might these things be used? I don't think anytime soon. I mean, so what are we going to try to do? First, we're going to try to get imaging possibilities into these nanoparticles that would be useful in humans so that we could see these things in an MRI or a CT scan. Then we will probably move to larger animals than mice, things like pigs that have a vascular system that's somewhat more like human than mice are. And pigs actually do get heart disease. You don't need to have a knockout mouse, partly because they live longer, and so on. And then, if all that looks good, we could start to proceed toward a clinical trial kind of thing, where, first of all, you would test for safety. All phase one clinical trials, at least in the United States, dwell entirely on safety. If you haven't proven any efficacy in animals, you will not get to try safety in human beings. But that's the way the progression goes. I don't see, though, that all of us will be getting an injection of these micelles just to check for heart disease. I think these would be things that would be used in cases where there was a family history or some reason to think that maybe we should be looking for very early stages of heart disease. But I think these things have a real chance of being valuable therapeutic, diagnostic and therapeutic agents. So back to this P4 medicine, what we're talking about, what I've just been telling you about, fits over here in the emerging technologies as a way of developing new information and enabling us to look more closely, for example, at what's going on in the heart or the brain or some other part of the body. What Lee Hood envisions and has talked about a lot is the idea that, in 10 years or so, every individual is going to be surrounded by a cloud of data, not just of the kind that I've talked about, but genomic, proteomic, which means how the genomic message is being transcribed into proteins, and a lot of other kinds of information, and that we're going to be taken care of in an environment that tries to interpret and synthesize these data so that we can make intelligent decisions about our own healthcare. The point that he's trying to get across is that having access to an understanding of this data cloud enables us to be proactive about our own healthcare. In other words, we can start to see the evolution of things. We can use these things to try to maintain wellness, that these things will be tailored to individuals, and that we don't have to deal with the law of averages in a way like standard medical care is now, but rather deal with situations that result from information about our own bodies. So what he's talking about is, instead of a kind of linear, traditional model of data to application of knowledge, there'll be a more holistic, integrated approach, which he calls the 4I approach to P4 medicine, that involves information, integration, interaction, and innovation. We'll see. I think the first part of this talk is really true. The idea that we're going to be surrounded by a data cloud and that we're going to have to understand that data cloud a lot more and take an active role in our own health and wellness is certainly true. How that'll get implemented in the context of the healthcare systems in our various countries remains to be seen. So I want to close with just a couple of slides telling you where we stand with establishing molecular engineering at the University of Chicago. By molecular engineering, we don't just mean engineering molecules. I was surprised to discover this afternoon that the chemistry department at Peking University calls itself the College of Chemistry and Molecular Engineering, and they've been called that since 1994. They view molecular engineering as the creation of molecules, which, you know, is certainly a legitimate interpretation of the English language of applied to that. We really mean something different, something that might be a little bit more legitimately called molecular systems engineering, building functional systems from the molecular level up, what a lot of people would call nanotechnology, but taking building blocks that have interesting electronic, mechanical, optical, chemical, biological properties and making functional systems that can compute and interact biologically and store energy and do things that are environmentally sound. And that's what we mean by molecular engineering. We now have a faculty of 10. This is the Faculty of Molecular Engineering at the University of Chicago. There's material scientists here, bioengineers, computational scientists, and even one theatrical producer and director covering our arts, science, and engineering interests. I've taken the technical themes here and tried to distribute the people around them. So we have interests in quantum materials engineering. We have interests in bioengineering. We have interests in engineering water resources and in soft materials. We have people that cover all of these with the possible exception of energy harvesting and storage. This is 9 people. We have the authority to hire at least 25 people, so we're going to fill in a lot of these gaps, possibly even create a few more themes. But we're well on our way to having the nucleus of expertise in several important molecular engineering themes. So I just wanted to leave you, and I'm not going to say anything more, but I'm happy to answer any questions, with a kind of a concrete view of what the faculty and the thematic directions of the Institute for Molecular Engineering are. So thank you for coming out tonight and listening.
So we'll have a few minutes for questions, if anyone has questions either about the content of the talk or about the IME.
Sure. They want to record everything, so you're on. Just talk.
Small question. Wondering, when you try those targeting nanoparticles for diagnostics purpose, whether you also tried to sort of combine that with some molecules with curing properties so that you can utilize that for therapeutic purposes.
Yeah, I did have a slide on that, but I went by it very quickly. And so there's a couple of things to say about it. Yes, that would be, that's one of the advantages of using particles like this. It's actually a lot easier to think about how to do that for cancer when you're just trying to kill cells when you get there than it is for heart disease. It's a little bit challenging to think about what the right kind of therapy to deliver to an atherosclerotic plaque would be. I showed you very briefly a situation where we delivered an anticoagulant peptide, so we could deliver something that would probably prevent a massive blood clot from forming. So that might be one thing. It wouldn't really treat the heart disease, but it would prevent some of the worst consequences of the heart disease. You could also think about something that would be more effective in transporting lipid away. Or you could think about something functionally equivalent to aspirin that would prevent blood clots from forming. So I think there are lots of things you could think about. The points that I'm trying to make are several fold. I think you could definitely do this for cancer, because you know what you want to do when you get to a tumor, which is kill the cells in the tumor. It's harder to do it for heart disease because we're not really sure what would work once we got there. But this whole idea of doing therapeutics and diagnostics at the same time actually has a name now in our National Institute of Health in the States called theranostics, quite a clumsy sounding word. But that's what they mean, diagnostics and therapeutics combined.
Sure, in the back.
You're next, John.
I was surprised to see that your micelles not ended up in adipocytes. So could you comment why it's not?
Why they don't end up in fat cells, you mean?
Right.
Well, I'm not sure, but they really don't. They are definitely cleared from the body largely through the kidneys and into urine. You're thinking that because they have a fatty tail on them. It kind of depends upon what ultimately happens to the micelle once it gets there. And that, of course, implies something else, which I didn't really say explicitly. But we know that the micelles get there intact. These micelles are not held together by covalent bonds, so they can come apart. But in fact, they don't come apart between the time that we inject them in the tail vein and they end up at the target. We know this by a couple of experiments that we've done. For example, we can make micelles where the fluorescent molecule is on the same molecule as the targeting peptide, or where it's in the same micelle, but it's on a different molecule. And we still get the fluorescence in the tumor or at the plaque. So they'd only, if they came apart, the fluorescence would never get there. So maybe it's because the micelle stays together and the lipid stays in the core. But I'm not really sure.
Thank you for the wonderful presentation. I'm interested in these five different areas, focal areas,
yeah.
Focus areas. Is one of them farther ahead than the others, and why would that be?
Yeah.
Because it's a little, I'm just curious about how these sort of...
Yeah. That's perfectly legitimate question. So what are we trying to do with the Institute for Molecular Engineering? Besides doing engineering from the molecular level up, we're also not trying to recreate a standard engineering school. Not because we think there's anything wrong with standard engineering schools, it's that there are a lot of good ones, and we don't want to copy them or do a Me Too kind of thing, and we have a rare opportunity to try something different. So instead of creating chemical engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, we're creating water and immunoengineering and quantum information engineering. We're starting with the problem, that's right. Now, some of these problem areas are the intrinsic interests of the faculty members that we've got. Like these two guys, along with Julia, are really some of the world's experts on trying to make devices based on manipulating quantum states in solid materials. And by quantum states, I mean flipping the spins of electrons as a switching mechanism or something like that. So that one is derived by the fact that there are people in the world that think that's what one of the things that's going to get us beyond Moore's law, and we have some of the best people trying to do it. That's also true in our approach to bioengineering based on immunology. Jeff and Melody and June and to some extent me all have ideas about how to use bioengineering and biomaterials directed toward the immune system. But in other cases, they're based on partnerships. And the two cases where partnerships have dictated the themes and they're drawing us in are water and energy storage. In the case of water, it's our partnership with Ben-Gurion University in Israel, where we've decided to try to tackle some problems in water purification in partnership with them. And I could tell you what they are in more detail. In the case of energy storage, it's that We are closely allied with Argonne National Laboratory in Chicago, which is a major Department of Energy laboratory. And they are considered the premier laboratory in North America for battery research. And we've agreed that we're going to hire some people and develop that theme in conjunction with them. So there's different reasons why we've picked particular themes. But you shouldn't think about these things as kind of substitutes for chemical engineering, mechanical engineering, and electrical engineering. That is, we're not going to have a water department and a quantum department and a immunology department. We are not a school of engineering as much as we are an engineering research and education institute. So you're right, exactly. We are outwardly focused. Rather than focusing mainly on what the toolkit is, we're trying to focus on what the problems are and assemble a team of first-rate faculty members to help guide tackling solutions to those problems.
Most of your funding comes from private sources so far, right? Pritzker.
Well, yeah, although we...
Because Argonne gets government money.
Yeah, and we're applying for all different kinds of agency grants, but... So it's a mixture of public and federal agency grants.
All right, did I see another question over here? Yeah.
Hello. Thank you for the speech. Actually, I want to ask a specific question.
Sure.
For the breast cancer, it's not a big cancer yet, but it's going to be because you feel pain, a sting pain. At the beginning and later on, you know, when you touch, you know there's something inside. And after checked, it's not cancer yet, but it's very possibly going to be. And after months medication, this nothing changed. And the chance doctor actually from the same hospital give different advice, different medicines. So for me, actually, I do want to know if there in United States, is there any actually better curing way for getting completely cured? And also, everybody knows for this one, mostly because you get upside, sadness, anger, a lot of anger. And besides, of course, this depends on different people, but there would be also a lot of violence. So to cause this disease, but in the same environment, you have to stay in the same environment. So how you not, even after you get cured and not make it come back again and again? Thank you.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what the real gist of your question was that relates to anything I know about. I would not argue that we have any particular ways of dealing with these things in the United States that are any better than anywhere else. The only thing I can say is that we are motivated by trying to produce early detection of diseases that are not yet producing obvious symptoms. That's the goal of nanotechnology in these environments. But we're a long way from solutions that are directly implementable in human beings. So I wouldn't claim any special expertise on that from our side yet. Well, we can't create another cure in anything that I'm familiar with without detection. We have to know what it is we are dealing with. And so we're entirely aimed at the detection methods in the early stages, not so much at the treatment methods yet.
Any more questions? If not, I think we can break for refreshments. And of course, Professor Terrell will be around to speak to you if you'd like to come up and ask him some questions yourself as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you
for this wonderful speech.
Thanks.